Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. After settlement, the court has two matters on its oral submission docket for this morning. In the order they will be presented, they are as follows. Wallace Bailey Jr. versus Van Scott Concrete Company, doing business as Express Pennington from Tarrant County, and Corpus Christi People's Baptist Church Incorporated versus the Nueces County Appraisal District and others from Nueces County. In each cause, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you wish to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear arguments for petitioner in Bailey versus Van Scott.
May it please the court, Mr. Don Prager will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Wallace Bailey Jr. was a cement contractor, was employed to pour the foundation on a home in Tarrant County. On October 4, 1986, is the date of injury. Prior to this occasion, either Mr. Bailey or the general contractor, Job Construction Company, ordered the concrete from Express Pennington, a well-known cement company in Tarrant County. It was delivered in trucks bearing the logo Express Pennington on its doors. In fact, Bailey talked to the salesman who appeared at the job site, and that's Express Pennington's salesman. Mr. McClure, a vice president of Tarmac Texas Inc., testified at time of trial that he was a vice president of Tarmac Texas Inc., and that's the surviving corporation after a merger, and that even 5 years after the accident, that's 1991, they were still running trucks saying Express Pennington on the trucks. Now, while Mr. Bailey is working away, the fourth truck dumps the concrete, and as Mr. Bailey so aptly says in the statement of facts, there was something wrong with that mud. It was watery, it was splashed on him, it went down his boots and burned holes in his legs, and he was severely injured, and it still is. Now, Mr. Osborne, Mr. Bailey's attorney, was given the delivery ticket when the concrete is delivered, and that's plaintiff's exhibit 2 in your exhibit list. The delivery ticket says Express Pennington, pay either company, and saw the name Express Pennington and went down to the assumed name records. And this is all in your statement of fact, excuse me, your transcript and your exhibits. And discovered that Van Scott Concrete Company was the owner or the legal entity operating Express Pennington. I use those words collectively, Express Concrete and Pennington Concrete. And then Mr. Osborne, and this is acknowledged in page 5 of respondent's brief, this is where you'll find this acknowledgement, called the Secretary of State of the state of Texas, said, who is the registered agent for service for Van Scott Concrete Company? And they said, Mr. Vance Minner, who was served. Van Scott Concrete Company answered, went through discovery, took Mr. Bailey's deposition, then filed 3.5 years after the injury a Rule 93-2 motion, a verified motion that he was not sued in the proper capacity.
Counsel, as a matter of fact, though, Van Scott no longer existed at that time. Is that right?
That's what we're here for, Judge. I insist that it existed very much so. It had gone through a merger, however.
But as a separate entity, it no longer existed.
As a separate entity, it no longer existed because...
But there was an assumed name statute.
Yes, sir.
Affidavit filed.
Yes, sir.
And the attorneys came into court and represented Vanscott Concrete.
Yes, sir.
But there was no Vanscott Concrete.
Well, now, you're using different words than I'd use. It had gone through a merger, and I think that's one of the issues today, is what effect a merger has on the separate identity of a merged company. I think that's the very issue which I'm moving into now. It's undisputed that the merger took place 3 months before Mr. Bailey got hurt. We're not disputing that in any way.
If Vanscott had gone out of business and had dissolved, filed, merely dissolved as a corporation, what would have been your remedy, Mr. Bailey's remedy?
I think if it had gone through a dissolution, we probably wouldn't have a remedy. If we did have a cause of action, certainly it would be could be satisfied through the dissolution rules, which gives you a claim against the fund.
But if it had gone through a dissolution, it wouldn't have been there to...
But if it goes through a dissolution, then we've sued the wrong defendant, I would think. Then I think the records would, at least the Secretary of State's records would show that it had gone through a dissolution. Remember that we have no notice that Tarmac ever existed, never heard the name, until the motion for summary judgment was made in 3.5, close to 4 years later. The name was meaningless. Now, in fact, no one had heard of the name except perhaps the principals involved. Now, we take the position...
And the Secretary of State.
Sir?
And the Secretary of State.
Only the Secretary of State, insofar as the Tarmac records were concerned, because we got the name of the registered agent from Vanscott, the non-existing corporation. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Mr. Prager, if you had simply sued Express Pennington and you'd had an officer of Express Pennington serve, which could have been Mr. Minter, wasn't he a vice president of this Tarmac?
No, no.
Would we even be here today?
Mr. Minter was president of Vanscott.
But after the merger, wasn't he also an officer?
I believe the records show that he is.
And as a result, isn't the only reason we're here is because the plaintiff named Vanscott as the defendant as opposed to simply naming Express Pennington?
I would believe that Mr. Osborne's problems would certainly be lessened if he just sued Express Pennington, the assumed name, went forward on Express Pennington, and under Rule 28, I believe that would be enforceable against the truly responsible party once it's established. Quite the contrary, I think Mr. Osborne tried to do this correctly, checked in every way, satisfied himself who was the legal entity that operated Express Pennington. Now, he did, of course, seek and receive the property management, adding DBA Express Pennington. And under the two cases that have studied that, that has a relation back theory that relates back to the last affirmative plea, which would be plaintiff's original petition. So I have no hesitation in saying that Vanscott, DBA Express Pennington was the plaintiff. All the evidence in the case related to Express Pennington.
Do you agree that Tarmac has never been sued in this case?
Tarmac has never been named as a defendant. I believe the use of the word Express Pennington moves it into making Tarmac equally liable in its corporate capacity as Vanscott.
Except
but it's never
Tarmac,
been named.
But Tarmac has never been served either.
No, sir. In fact, it has different registered agents.
To achieve the result you wish to achieve, wouldn't this court have to determine that
a corporation that merges with another corporation somehow stays in existence for the purposes of, or if they've done assumed name, if they do business under an assumed name, and that certificate is never changed, the corporation that goes out of existence by way of merger continues to exist for the purposes of future liability?
Absolutely. You hit right on the head, Judge.
Do you have any authority that,
yes, sir,
says that's what it is?
Yes, sir. Your merger statutes provide, this is Article 501, no shareholder of a domestic corporation that is a party to a merger will, as a result of such merger, become personally liable without his consent for the liabilities or obligations of any other person. So the merger statutes bill to protect the stockholder of the merged corporation, and as they well should, because the merged corporation moves into the surviving corporation that assumes those liabilities. The merger statute states the separate existence of the merged corporation shall cease, but the dissolution statutes say not separate existence, that the existence. In fact, Article 712 says, however, a dissolved corporation may not continue its corporate existence, not separate existence, for purposes of continuing the business or affairs for which the corporation was organized. Further on, it states with some more specificity, upon issuance of such certificate of dissolution, the existence of the corporation shall cease. So, under the Code Construction Act, the legislature intends for each word to have meaning and to be given its ordinary definition. We have the merger statutes saying that its separate existence ceases, and we have the dissolution statutes over here saying its existence ceases. And we have to put meaning to the word separate, otherwise we wouldn't put it in there. And it means just what it says.
Wouldn't it, but Ms. Frager, doesn't that go to whether or not a shareholder picks up personal liability to the extent the shareholder receives some sort of distribution from the corporation? A corporation that goes out of existence that distributes assets to the shareholder is liable for the debts of the corporation at the time it ceases to exist to the extent of whatever they receive back.
Precisely.
It might be just the value of their stock, but it might be other assets.
Could
be. Wasn't the merger statute designed to recognize a separate existence ceases, but intends to not, by that event of merger, make the shareholders somehow liable for having received assets that they owned of the pre-existing corporation that gets transferred to the merger corporation? Is that all that's designed to?
Judge, I believe what the intent was that claimants, creditors, regardless of what they may be, can seek their satisfaction from the surviving corporation. Therefore, the stockholders should be shielded from those of the merged corporation. I believe that was the intent, that there is a remedy for claimants against merged corporations.
In either event, doesn't that presuppose the liability exists before the corporation goes out of business, either through merger or dissolution? So both of those presuppose some sort of debt that exists or liability on the part of the corporation prior to going out of business?
Yes, sir. I believe that's correct. I believe that is what that was intended. Yes, sir. That's your question.
So if Van Scott is out of business at the time this claim arises, do those have any applicability to these circumstances?
Not if Van Scott was out of business, which brings me to my point. Van Scott was not out of business. Now, this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court for three reasons. One, that Van Scott continued on within the corporate structure of Tarmac. It never lost its identity, and as long as that assumed name record, which is well before the court, said that Van Scott was the corporate entity operating Express Pennington, it retains its separate identity, yes, within the framework of Tarmac, and it is liable within the framework of Tarmac, even though, because it still existed at the time Mr. Bailey got hurt. Now, secondly, the assumed names. The record, I don't think it's disputed, that Van Scott used Express Pennington as its business logo, trademark, name. And Tarmac used Express Pennington. The evidence is clear that Tarmac continued to use Express Pennington, and they acknowledge that. Mr. McClure's testimony, yes, sir, we're doing business under Express Pennington. And if Van Scott used Express Pennington, merged into Tarmac, and Tarmac used Express Pennington without ever changing those assumed name records, then Van Scott, DBA Express Pennington, is certainly an assumed name of Tarmac. Now, the Mustafa case, which we cite in our brief, says you don't have to amend. Says the assumed name itself gets you into the corporate entity. That's a Court of Appeals case out of Fort Worth. I believe my time's up.
What's your third one?
Oh, the third one is the Rule 93 bit. The Level case states that if a plaintiff does not sues in the wrong corporate capacity, the defendant must complain. If he doesn't complain, it has waived its complaint. In that case, it should have been a corporate plaintiff and it was an individual plaintiff. It's waived. This court had, that's a 1988 case. This court clearly said you waived your Rule 93 defense. This court should find that if a party follows a Rule 93 defense, it should do so as soon as it realizes it has that defense, or at least during the period of limitations. I realize there could be a situation.
I think you've gone beyond just answering the question.
Excuse me.
Any other questions? The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniel L. Gates will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Bates from Fort Worth. I represent the non-existent Van Scott Concrete Company, Incorporated.
Mr. Bates, on that point specifically, as I understand, Mr. Prager, that Van Scott continued to exist after the merger, as with Tarmac. You say that it no longer existed?
The direct answer to your question is no, it's existence ceased.
Why did y'all file an answer for them then if they didn't exist?
Well, because you can't raise the issue as to whether you exist unless you join the issue.
But did you raise that issue in your answer?
Yes, Your Honor. That issue was raised by the general denial originally filed by the counsel who originally had the case. It was subsequently, an amendment was subsequently made, which verified the lack of corporate existence of Van Scott Concrete Company.
All within the period of limitation?
The amendment was not
Was that 4 years later?
The amendment was not within the period of limitation. If it would please the court, I think there are several key facts, and what I'd like to do for about 2 or 3 minutes is run through a chronology of events in the hopes that it would assist the court in having a clear fact pattern as to what happened in this case. First of all, in August of 1984, and this is Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 in the Statement of Facts, Vanscott Concrete Company filed two assumed name certificates in the Tarrant County Assumed Name Records. One, DBA Express Concrete Company. The second one on the same day, DBA Pennington Concrete Company. No assumed name record has ever existed to our knowledge, nor is there any reference to it in the Statement of Facts or at the trial of the case about Express Pennington. We had two assumed name certificates, one Express Concrete Company, the other Pennington Concrete Company. There's no evidence that I recall in the record that addresses that anybody ever filed any DBA Express Pennington.
What was on the side of the truck?
Justice Becker, I believe the evidence was, according to Mr. Bailey, that on the side of the truck it said Express Pennington. I know for sure that the load ticket had Express Pennington on it.
With a hyphen?
No, ma'am, I don't believe it was just Express and then underneath Pennington. That's, I believe that's Plaintiff's Exhibit number two.
Were both of these assumed name certificates on file by Vanscott?
By Vanscott Concrete Company, Inc. That's correct.
Mr. Bates, are you contesting that Vanscott was ever doing business as Express Pennington?
No, sir. I believe that the record probably is that Tarmac Texas, Inc. was doing business as Express Pennington.
No, that's not my question.
I'm
are
sorry.
You contesting whether Vanscott was ever doing business as Express Pennington?
I don't know that, Judge, and that was not proven at the trial. Please understand that by order of the court on April the 5th, 1991, in my motion filed on March the 28th, 1991, I was substituted in as counsel of record. We went to trial in the case 10 days after the order was signed substituting me in. So that's why I have to rely upon what developed in trial, because I really didn't have any time to do a lot of independent investigation to some of the sequence of events which occurred.
Well, let me ask you this, and is it your position that without an assumed name certificate on file, a plaintiff could not sue a corporation under its assumed name?
No, I think Rule 28 provides that you can sue one under assumed name regardless of whether the legal formality of the filing of an assumed name certificate has been fulfilled or not. The problem, of course, in this case is that on June the 20th of 1986, Defense Exhibit 2 to the Statement of Facts, there was a plan and agreement of reorganization by merger and certificate of merger made by the Secretary of the State of Texas, by which three ready-mix concrete outfits, Vanscott, Hoveringham USA, Inc., and Syntex Ready-Mix Concrete Company, Inc., merged, the survivor being Syntex, who in the same documents and the same procedure renamed itself to Tarmac Texas, Inc.
Let me understand this. You don't know if Vanscott ever used the Express Pennington logo on its trucks. Tarmac did use Express Pennington logo on
that's,
its trucks,
that's that
but
one.
The assumed name certificates never changed.
The assumed name certificates never
they
changed.
They were still in Vanscott's name.
Tarmac still
never used an filed an assumed name certificate.
Not at any material time that I know about, Your Honor.
Okay. Seems to me that there's, very least, there's some equitable estoppel here.
Well,
you've got the same entity that's merged with other entities. It performs under another name. It's not on file, so there's no public notice unless you go check the merger certificates.
Well, that's an important
point. You can't rely on the assumed name certificates.
Okay. Well, that's an important point that we'll get to in the chronology of events to specifically address your question, Justice Enoch. The trial record shows that Vance C. Minner was not an officer of the survivor corporation Tarmac, because in Defense Exhibit 2 to the Statement of Facts, in the plan and reorganization of merger, it lists who the officers and directors of CarMax Texas, Inc. are going to be, and Vance C. Minter's not on the list. There's not anything in the trial record that connects Vance C. Minter, the former president of Van Scott Concrete Company, Inc., with the survivor CarMax Texas, Inc. And we think that is an important fact because the wrong party literally was sued and served.
Where was Minter's when he was served?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
Isn't there something in the record that indicates he was at the offices of what otherwise was Van Scott that were now the offices of CarMax? Isn't that in the record?
I don't recall that in the record, Judge. I reread the statement of facts
yesterday
or the day before, but I don't recall that being in the record. The only person who testified was from CarMax, James McClure, and I doubt seriously he knew where Mr. Minter was. But whether he was or whether he wasn't, regardless of the geography is, the record is that Vance C. Minter in effect sold his business and did not continue on and is not an officer of CarMax. So it's not a Rule 28 type or misnomer, I think was maybe what you had in mind, whether this was a misnomer issue where you sue someone who is affiliated with the survivor, and the record is that's not the case. So 90 days after the certificate of merger, more or less, we have the date of the accident. Then the original petition is filed about 7 months before limitation would have run in 1988, filed on March the 15th, 1988.
The proper party would have been Texas CarMax, or CarMax Texas, Inc.?
The proper party, I think under the evidence, would be CarMax Texas, Inc.
And let me ask you, if Van Scott had withdrawn the assumed name certificate or the successor, CarMax Texas, Inc. had withdrawn Van Scott's assumed name certificate, wouldn't a reasonable search of the records have led a lawyer to discover that the merger had taken place in 1986?
That would have been certainly additional notice by way of the assumed name records.
And I guess my question is, why, if a lawyer does a search of the assumed name records and is misled to his client's detriment by an erroneously outstanding assumed name certificate and relies to their detriment on that assumed name certificate, why should we hold that as between the two parties that Van Scott in this context should prevail on a technicality?
Well, two lines of analysis. First, the law is that Van Scott didn't exist to have done anything or failed to have done anything before the planning. The second line of analysis.
To follow up on Judge Gamage's question, essentially on an estoppel basis. I understand as a legal matter that you may be correct, but it is based on an estoppel argument. Why didn't your client stop to deny
that they exist?
Right.
So as I understand, the question is why should the law be that someone who ceased to exist continue to exist just because they don't take the procedural step of drawing down their assumed name record?
Misleading litigants to their detriment.
Well, misleading connotes some intent to do that. Certainly there's no mens rea or anything in the record. I think it's merely an outfit that goes out of business, who sells out in effect, fails to take that procedural step, and the outfit who's been operating like that for 90 days failed to get around to have done it at least at the material time. So I don't know, we reject respectfully, Your Honor, the misleading aspect, because we told the whole world who really wanted to know and would exercise any diligence to know what had happened, and that was on file since June of 1986, 90 days before the calamity. In fact,
What would put a litigant on notice that they should look beyond the assumed name certificate for this merger in 1986?
Well, to make sure that you've got the right party, which is, I think, something, an inherent burden that the plaintiff bears.
So they cannot rely on an assumed name certificate filed in accordance with the requirements
of the
law?
Well, they can rely upon the fact that 2 years before the certificate was filed. But I think the other important point is that at page 212, lines 1 through 25 of the statement of facts, plaintiff's counsel puts a record that he called the Secretary of State's office to identify Vance Minner as the reservation of service process. So he had the Secretary of State's office on the phone. The information is there for the asking. And so apparently what happened is that plaintiff's counsel didn't say, by the way, what's the current status of Vanscott Concrete Company, which presumably, if that one question would have been asked while he had him on the phone, he would have found out that there was a merger. And so the information was there. He's talking to the office where the information is had. And
I understood you a minute ago to say, Vanscott, to use your words, was an outfit that went out of business. I understood you to say Vanscott was an outfit that went out of business.
Well, I think I was addressing...
Then just now you say Vanscott merged. Now, did they cease to exist completely, or did they emerge?
Well, they merged, which according to Article 5.06A1 of the Business Corporation Act, it says that their separate existence ceases. Now,
their separate existence.
Yes, sir. Now the law provides for successor liability, taking care of the fact that had Vanscott in its existence before the merger committed some tort, then that liability would have survived and gone on to the successor corporation. However,
that's the reason why the answer was made without calling the attention to the court that this Vanscott no longer existed.
Well, Judge, I can't speak for the former counsel. All I can say is that each and every allegation was originally denied. The plaintiff never sent one interrogatory, never propounded one request for admission.
Are you attempting here to revive a general demur? So what? We don't follow that practice anymore. We used special exceptions last time I checked.
Well, the amendment was made certainly timely, in that the amendment was made on June the 20th, 1990, some 8 months before the trial.
And after the statute had run?
Yes, Your Honor.
Up till that time, everything presented in the way your trucks operated, the way your labels or shipping orders operated, and the way you signed your pleadings suggested that the entity that was sued was an entity that was a going concern.
I think that's right, Judge, but here is what I think the real point is. That the plaintiff has, I think all of these are great tolling of limitation arguments. The problem, it seems to me, in this case, is that when they filed their amended answer on June the 20th of 1990, and spoon-fed, if you'll let me be indelicate, the information, because nobody had ever asked before. They didn't ask the Secretary of State. They didn't propound one interrogatory. They didn't do one request for admission, one document production, one deposition, no nothing. So when the information was spoon-fed by way of the amended pleading on June the 20th, 1990, had Mr. Bailey at that time sued Tarmac Texas Inc., and Tarmac Texas Inc. would have come in and said, oh, I'm sorry, limitation, then I think perhaps there is, with some reason, saying, no, I'm sorry, Tarmac, you don't benefit from the limitation because you didn't update the assumed name certificate, this kind of thing. But what we're about here today is a request for this court to change a ruling that it made in the Dillard versus Smith case, and some NREs and some lower courts' opinions, whereby the procedural aspects of amending or filing assumed name certificates are converted into substantive liability against an entity, in the case of Tarmac, that's never been named, never been served, never had as an entity its day in court.
Isn't it somewhat disingenuous to argue that, and I don't think anyone will argue that once a corporation has dissolved, once there's been a dissolution, it ceases to exist as any kind of entity. But its assets are still available for legitimate claims against it. But a merged entity doesn't cease to exist. It ceases to exist as a separate entity, but it continues to exist as a merged entity, as a part of the whole. Isn't it somewhat disingenuous to argue that the new merged entity, the whole, if it continues to use logos and identification that was legitimately utilized by one of its parts, should, at least by estoppel principles, be successor to some liability or be subject to some liability through the use of that name when there's nothing on record to give the public or any claimant notice that the former separate entity is not continuing to use that identification, and then in the process of litigation not to give any specific notice that that no longer exists, it's now a part of another entity until after limitations have run against the new entity? Isn't it a little disingenuous to proceed that way?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all the world had noticed the office that the plaintiff's lawyer was in contact by telephone had the information. The information was just not solicited.
Aren't you saying there that the public has no right to rely upon what the law puts there so they can rely upon it, the assumed name certificates?
Well, I'm not saying that it has no right to rely on the information. However, in the real world in which we all live, all of these things happen. And while this court has not reversed, and the medical Sierra Medical Center Wedner case says that assumed name certificates are procedural. They don't affect the substantive rights of the party. The other reason it's not disingenuous, Your Honor, is the fact that Tarmac Texas, the sum of the parts, has never been sued. Never been sued to this day. So I hear and I understand and certainly anticipated the feelings of some of the justices, and I think these are perhaps powerful statute of limitations arguments if someone would have bothered, even after they found out, to sue Tarmac. But what you're talking about doing here is resurrecting, or in effect changing the Business Corporation Act to resurrect the existence of an entity who had been sued separately, who had been served separately, but whose separate existence has ceased, and then make substantive changes in the liability law, which, if the court is going to do that, I implore the court not to do that, because all that would have had to happen.
I think you're past the answer and the argument. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Just so I would ask that the case, if it's reversed, be remanded rather than
remanded. Have your briefs.
Just a few words. The answer, I believe, is judging this question. I have a return, and that's page 10 and 11. Judge, it says, 1200 Summit Building, Tarmac, Texas, 6000 South Hempfield. One's the plant, one's the office building. It says Vanscott Concrete Company, Express Pennington. These are handwritten things put in by the Concord Sheriff. The return shows that
they were using the same locations. A couple of words. The materially misleading assumed name records. The Bar Committee's comment states, this section requires that a new certificate be filed whenever an event occurs, which causes the information previously filed to become materially misleading. The examples given are the type of events that will generally require a new filing, including such occurrences as change in name, loss of identity as though through a merger. So the legislature and the Bar Committee, which makes recommendations to the legislature, were fully aware when they said if it becomes materially misleading and you don't change it, it's a criminal act. In Article 36, Subsection 26 says that you're going to be fined $2,000. In that regard, I believe it's the Florida statute. Also, it's going to put you in jail for a year for not doing it. These are penal statutes. And the reason is because we need these assumed name records in order to have business stability. You just cannot have business stability if you don't know for whom you're dealing, with whom you're dealing.
Mr. Prager, how do you respond to Mr. Bates' comment that all of the discussion here really is pertinent to an issue of whether or not the statute of limitations were told until you obtain the correct identity of the party sued, but that never occurred even after the answer was filed? Tarmac to this day has not been named or sued.
Judge, I can't answer that. As I understand the law, when you sue the right defendant and serve the wrong one, statute runs. When you, I'm generalizing here. When you sue the wrong one and serve the right one, the statute is told until you amend. Now, in this case, we've got to look at two things. First of all, why amend? Until almost 4 years later, whenever it was first discovered, and incidentally, the name Tarmac Texas Inc. doesn't even come into the picture on the Rule 93 amended answer. There, it's just stated they're sued in the wrong capacity. Or they're not liable as sued. It wasn't until the motion for summary judgment was made that the name Tarmac Texas Inc. first appeared out of the air. And Your Honor, you're right. There is nothing to lead anyone to the name Tarmac Texas Inc. And if you'll look at those articles of merger, we still have another corporation, Trusa Investment Inc. I don't know where it comes in. Mr. Bates hasn't told us. But you'll find it in there that that's the stockholder of all the stock of Hoveringham, Van Scott, Syntex Concrete, and Tarmac. So it's a name game. Now, lastly, I think I want to say...
I don't think I understood your answer to Judge Enid's question.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I missed your answer to Judge Enid's question.
I'm sorry.
Why, after you did learn about Tarmac, didn't you amend and sue and serve them? And if you didn't, how come?
Because we considered the statute to have run at that point, and it would just be an act of futility, Your Honor. We were going with Van Scott as Express Pennington, depending on Rule 28, and to put in Tarmac and subject Tarmac to a motion for summary judgment or perhaps special exception, since on the face the statute had run, not just barely run by at that point 4 years, 2 years after the statute had run, to be an exercise in futility.
Mr. Prager, let me ask you, Mr. Bates suggests that perhaps it would be appropriate for a lawyer who files a lawsuit, as the trial lawyer did in this case, to send an interrogatory to ask whether there's some defect in parties before limitations run so that an amendment can be made. What is your response to that suggestion?
My response to that, Your Honor, is obviously, I knew someone was asking, is that Mr. Osborne was absolutely certain that he had the right parties. He'd done everything that needed to be done. Now, this court has discussed excessive discovery and what have you. He had no reason to discover. Truly satisfied after looking at the documents, getting copies of the documents, using the documents to prepare his plea. Any other questions?
Anything else?
Lady?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll now take a brief recess.
Johnny, please rise.